November 7, 1980, California State University at Long Beach, Richard Wilde, interviewed by Kay Briegel. What do you remember about your first coming to Long Beach?
Well, I had been in England on a Fulbright and bought a little Austin A40, which I had delivered to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which was my home. I also had all my notes and books and things. I bought a lot of books and manuscripts and things. I had all that shipped to Milwaukee. And I'd come back really to in the spring of 1951. I had to pass my oral exams, my final exams for the doctorate at the University of Wisconsin, and booked to Madison to do that. And then, of course, I was on the job list and prepared to move into Madison to be interviewed if necessary. And I don't know if I've talked about that on the previous tape or not, have I?
No, not to be interviewed.
Oh, I see. Well, I was then interviewed at the University of Wisconsin by Peter Victor Peterson, and I was rather amazed by the interview in the sense he seemed to be more interested in me and my personal experiences. The fact that I'd been in the war in the Pacific and been in Europe as a Fulbrighter. He asked about my religious affiliations and other things of that sort. I remember saying that my parents were Lutheran, which was an evasion of the issue, but I thought could not be harmful talking to Peterson. There weren't many jobs available. The whole of the history department was much smaller than in Wisconsin, and it might be interesting to record this because it's part of the state of the profession. As I recall, there were about 15 of us in European and English history, and maybe 15, 20 or so in American history. Faculty must at the University of Wisconsin must have been 15 or 20, probably closer to 15. And this was just at the beginning when things were expanding, you know. And even so, in 1951, there weren't jobs. I mean, a great expansion had not yet begun. So everybody was scrambling for these interviews, and everybody thought I was very lucky to get the job. As I recall, princely salary was about $4,000. $250 or something like that per annum. Everybody thought it was great. The only trouble was I couldn't find Long Beach State College because, of course, it existed only for 2 years and wasn't on any maps. You could find City College in Long Beach, but you couldn't find Long Beach State College. I became concerned and I talked to people in the history department and said, is this a real place? I mean, this man wasn't interested really much in my scholarship or training. Didn't talk much about what I would teach or how I would approach teaching, but was interested in, you know, other kinds of things, and I assured there is a place called Long Beach State College, and they assured me that a new system was being created out here in California, and yes, there was such a place. Well, so it was at that point then where I began, talking. We decided we would camp on our way out here and visit some of the great sites in the West. Seen some of them. So we packed what we needed for that purpose in our Austin A40 and drove out here to California, packing up I don't know how many hundreds of crates of books. It seemed to me hundreds, maybe it wasn't that many, books and notes and all our possessions to be shipped out here. And visited with some friends, camping and so on along the way. That's my first experience of the Western Desert, and, you know, this whole wide open country. I'd crossed the United States, of course, in a troop ship, in a troop train, in two directions, but I hadn't really had much experience of it. I'd done a little hiking in the Rockies and out in the Pacific Northwest because my wife's family originally came from there. She had a grandmother who lived up there. But I really hadn't seen the Southwest and so on. And I guess One of the important impressions I had was that we came over the mountains of California, the dry, brown, burnt aspect of it. Yeah, I thought of mountains, the only mountains I'd really experienced before, green and forested. And what you tended to see driving in wasn't quite that way. My wife was disappointed. And it was kind of, it wasn't really smoggy, but it was hot and unpleasant in August.
Yeah.
And we arrived here in Long Beach and stayed in a little motel on Pacific Coast Highway somewhere, as I recall. Then I set out to find Long Beach State College. Well, nobody knew where it was. Officially, it was still in the apartment buildings over here on Anaheim Road. Well, eventually, I did locate the place. I guess I got in touch with a telephone number and got directions. And I came onto campus for the first time, and of course I was utterly amazed at what I had joined. Even so, it was a going concern, and I got here, and people had been here 2 years before said, you should have been here 2 years ago. Looked around and discovered the library consisted of a small building about the size of three offices like this, a third of which was taken over by Charlie Borkman and his staff, and a third by the stacks, and a third by the desk for reading. And I said, my God, what have I got into? What am I going to do? There are no books. How do you conduct a college class? And looked around and discovered that much. And my first contact with anybody on campus was with Hugh Brown, who was, I've forgotten just what job he held. You can probably find him in the hierarchy. But anyway, he was educational policies and so on, rather than other kinds of administration. And he talked to me about what I would teach, and was a bit grumpy, because apparently Dr. Peterson had more or less hired people he liked. He didn't necessarily pay much attention to their specialties. So there was some doubt whether he needed four historians in the social science section. They already had two American historians, Alquist and Malin. And then they hired two other persons. They hired Dr. Kimball and they hired me at the same time. And we were both in English history, which there wasn't going to be that much demand for. So Hugh Brown was a bit grumpy. Not really at me, but here I was, a phenomenon which he had to cope with and which he didn't quite know what to do with. Well, it turned out, of course, that I had a variety of fields, and I think this much the president had asked me about. He said, can I teach a course called History of the Pacific? And I never heard of a history of the Pacific. It seemed to be an odd kind of history, but I said, yeah, I'd had 5 years of history, and I'd been in the Pacific in the war. Sure, I could, you know, I got a job, so I could do that. And could I teach European history? Yes, I had a field in European history. And I didn't press him as to whether I could teach English history. I figured, well, we'll worry about that when we get there. So a program had to be made. Well, apparently Dr. Malin had started his survey of English history, which he surrendered to me kindly. And then I talked with Howard Kimball, and he was willing to let me teach English history, so I got into English history. But Hugh Brown had been making a program, I guess agreed that I would take English history, and I was to do European history. I think I started with the Renaissance and Reformation and did 19th century Europe. I either did both of those in one semester or in some sort of order, and then I did Europe since 1914. I did three European history courses. And I did English history, and there still wasn't enough for me to do, so he said, could I teach U.S. history? Well, that's the one thing that I had studiously ignored throughout my graduate work was American history, really. I wasn't interested in working in that at all very much. But I had to have a field in it, so I had taken American diplomatic history, which took me into world affairs pretty much. That was my complete knowledge. So I got assigned to teach recent history of the United States, 20th century United States history. I said, well, it's going to be diplomatic history, I'm afraid, but that's it. So I had four classes. I think I had four preparations that were new to me that first semester and four new ones in the second. And so that it was either eight. If I repeated any course at all, it was only one. So it was either eight or seven courses that I had to prepare. This was normal. We were small. Everybody did that. But it was a real rat race. And there was no library, mind you. You either had to teach out of the books you owned, or you had to go off to UCLA or USC. Well, fortunately, Dr. Kimball and I became good friends very early. He had been teaching in a community college and had taught United States history and Western civilization, I guess. So he was prepared to be pretty adaptable. He said, look, I've talked before, you haven't. It'd be harder for you to adapt than it would be for me. He said, very graciously, let me do the one English history course we had. And in every way was, you know, very, very helpful. He and Ann Kimball were very kind. Louise, my wife, was pregnant. We expected a baby along about November sometime. And, of course, Ann and Harvard were older, and they had several children, and they thought they would kind of take us under their wing, I guess, and be helpful. So it was their kindness that really helped us settle down, pretty much. We were able to rent a house. The big housing tracts were already going up all over. And a lot of people were building speculatively because they had the GI Bill, and they figured they could make some money. The houses were going up in value, and they could rent them. So we got a brand new house that somebody bought on speculation. And I used to drive back and forth to the college through the bean fields and open fields that were the area around Alberti and the dairies and so on out to near Del Amo or south in that general area, a street called Eccleston Street. Oh yeah, nice little house. No furnishing, mind you. So we went out to buy things. Mainly we bought used things whenever we could. Finally got the place furnished the way we could live in it and make preparations for the arrival of the baby and all the rest. Well, my parents decided they wanted to see how we were getting on in California, so we just barely rented this house and settled down, and they descended with my sisters and so on. We had a nice visit. I remember my dad describing the hair-raising experience he had. He apparently drove over the Tioga Pass in the old days, when it was just a very narrow one-lane road. It was, I later drove over the same road, and so on. So it was quite an adventure for them. They'd never ventured out this far before in their lives, so on. So it was a kind of interesting and exciting time. I remember that I used to talk to people in England about what I thought would happen to me when I got here. And I said, well, I'll probably get a job in California or some ungodly place like that. I was kidding about it. I really didn't want to come to California particularly. The Middle West and the East seemed to me as still, you know, interesting parts of the world. I passed through San Francisco, had a chance to get a few days leave there. I was kind of interested. San Francisco was exciting, but Los Angeles. The general impression of the area made on my wife and me was not good. We weren't terribly happy. It didn't seem like the kind of place we wanted to settle down. It was dirty and hot and miserable. That's what it seemed to us. Actually, of course, the Middle West is just as uncomfortable because of the humidity and all the rest, but we weren't prepared really to become Southern California. I think it was years before we really adapted to the place. The Kimballs, of course, who were natives of California, at least Howard was, said, well, you just have to get used to it. The weather's different and so on. Get my clients. It wasn't so bad. Took us out for a few trips around to show us the beauties of Southern California. and all the rest. But it was interesting. This is all the personal side of getting settled down. But when you get to the teaching side of it, of course, many of the students were older, and were getting credentials. We were only an upper division institution in the early days. And indeed, the first official act, I think, that I did for the college was help move chairs from the apartments to the new temporary buildings that are down here on the mud flats as they were then. I think the social science area totally was about 11 faculty, including 4 were historians. The head of the social science area had just been brought in by the name of Carl Emerson Gregory. He was a Teachers College Columbia type and didn't believe in the individual disciplines in which all of his faculty had been trained. They wanted us all to teach a kind of a general social science program, sort of public school social science. This sat very badly with mostly everybody, I recall. So from the very beginning, we were, most of the faculty sort of locked in a unhappy relationship because we were trained in with doctoral programs in our own specialized disciplines and hoped somehow to sort of perpetuate what we had learned. And the place simply wasn't adapted to that very well to begin with. It wasn't equipped with a library or anything, and so it was a kind of a shocking experience to adapt to.
I don't think I understand what a public school social science program is. Maybe you could...
What the schools taught was social science. They tended not to teach individual. I mean, if you looked at the program of a student that said social science, maybe the content would be mainly American history and Constitution, or maybe it would be mainly world history or whatever. But two of the 4 years, at least, were a sort of a mixed social science, I guess, sociology, economics. I don't remember exactly what it was. But anyway, Dr. Gregory really didn't think we should teach our individual disciplines, but he thought we should teach an integrated social science. And he was going to redesign the whole curriculum around that. Whether or not the president wanted to do this, and he was asked to do it by the president, whether this was part of the circumstance in which he came or whether it was something he wanted to do on his own, I don't know. But, most pretty people wanted to do their own discipline and did not want to get involved in anything else to do. Indeed, the curriculum had started out in a very standard way. Dr. Alquist and the early people had simply set up sociology courses and political science courses and history courses. And they probably looked at the catalogs of the University of California, because the normal progression had been from community colleges into the university. The state colleges were now moving into that whole area. So probably they simply adapted their own training and what they saw. So that's the direction in which we started out, and that's incidentally where Hugh Brown was going too. Hugh Brown was something of an old traditionalist. I think he's Canadian in background. I don't think President Peterson ever really had much understanding or respect for the social sciences. I don't if he we'd all been sort of amalgamated into something general, it probably would have been better, because if you train people for something useful in life, you know, as he hoped that we would be doing, why maybe some sort of amalgamated, integrated course or two would be a good thing. That would be enough. So he may have had feelings in that direction. But I think it's important that probably Peterson and some of the other people that were in command positions had conceptions of what the curriculum was to be and where we were going, which probably were at odds with anything that any of us had experienced in our graduate training or would anticipate doing. The whole process of graduate training is sort of apprenticeship and, you know, laying on of hands and all the rest. So you really expect that you're going to go out and perpetuate the learning, you know, which you have been indoctrinated in. And that wasn't where the leadership of the university seemed to want to go. So I think that was really the seeds of an important cleavage and troubled relation. I'm reasonably sure that the people in the social sciences and some of the traditional disciplines were less happy than some of those that were in the more practical areas, even though President Peterson had very little respect for educationists. He was determined, for example, that student teaching would be supervised by academics and not by school education. And we're still in that pattern, which is unusual because of his prejudices against education. He saw certainly the value of science in practical areas, engineering. But he got in trouble with his own science faculty because he wanted them to teach kind of practical chemistry, and they wanted to teach more traditional courses. So my guess is that the applied areas would always have found his philosophy more compatible than the standard academic discipline. I think that was one of the areas of cleavage in South from the beginning. The faculty were all housed together in a gang office, all of the social sciences. And I had a desk in a part of one of the temporary buildings down there. It wasn't a place where you could do much work, of course. Most of it, there was no library to resort to. So it was kind of interesting. Some of the classes were taught off campus. I had an evening class. I taught at Wilson High. I didn't have enough rooms. The daytime classes we taught in the classrooms here on campus. And some of the classes were meeting off campus, and a lot of the evening ones were. The evening classes were always a fairly large complement, because most of our, well, I shouldn't say most, but probably almost half the students were probably teachers who were completing credentials in those early years. A lot of them were older. I remember the class I had to teach recent United States history to were mostly older than I was. And school teachers had probably been teaching American history. And it seemed to me a little bit odd. I gave them a strong dose of diplomatic history, which I felt I knew something about. Mixed in a lot of Far East and Europe, which I was teaching also at the same time. And so we survived. And I never taught any more U.S. history after that first year round. From that point on, I've done, I converted the history of the Pacific to the history of the Far East as quickly as I could.
Was there any resistance to that, or?
No, not actually. I don't know whether I had much argument about it. I don't think I had much argument about it. I said, you know, simply, look, you know, you've got these great traditional cultures of China and Japan, and they are the heart and soul of what you want to teach about. Pacific Islands are interesting, but they don't amount to that much, you know, in the terms of what's important in the world. So I was able to do that without too much trouble.
Yeah.
The other courses were pretty well set up. There was a survey of English history for a year, and there were at least, I think, three segments to modern Europe. That is, Renaissance, Reformation, 19th century, since 1914. So in that respect, I don't think there was a great deal of trouble. The idea was really to sort of abandon that and go into a general social science program, and that was these two things may have been moving together, you know. I don't recall that clearly, but I don't think there was a lot of resistance to that change. So that basically, I taught Far Eastern history and modern Europe and English history for many years. And I liked it very much. I liked European history. And in time, I added a British Empire course, and we expanded our English curriculum and so on. I don't know whether that was how many years it took to get around to that. The enrollments were not heavy in these some of these peripheral courses. I remember the whole system of registration involved everybody sitting around a group of desks. The students came in and they signed up on a piece of paper. And you sat there and you had these four pieces of paper in front of you. And if people weren't signing your piece of paper and were signing other pieces of paper, you wondered what was going to happen to you, you know, whether you'd be able to teach what you'd been scheduled to teach and perhaps done a little preparation on. I kind of resented this whole business of kind of sitting there and advertising your wares and getting people signed up. But that's where we did it in the early days. And I must say, the university permitted fairly small classes and permitted us to do what we wanted to do. There may have been a strong prejudice, you know, to do other than standard academic kinds of things, but there wasn't that close supervision, that management and control. And I think the effort was to get the faculty together and talk about creating a general social science curriculum, which we were all supposed to follow anyway, some of us. The difficulty was general social sciences was all present-oriented and concept-oriented and so on. And of course, history isn't that kind of a discipline, so it didn't fit in with this whole business very well. I think that may be one reason why the history people were a little unhappy with the way things were going. Well, I don't know if that's...
What was your relationship with the students? I mean, you kind of had that small bunch of bungalows, more or less, on mm-hmm. the lower campus. Did that allow interaction with the students?
Well, there was a lot of interaction. The students were, when we got to know them quite well, my classes were relatively small because I taught relatively specialized things. The English and American history classes, standard surveys and so on, were always somewhat larger. Maybe the sociology and some of the other classes were larger too. I don't really remember. The business classes, we had a few at the very beginning, were somewhat larger. So, you could get to know the students quite well. There was a lot of informality. 49er days, the faculty and the students were all out together. You know, I had some slides of those early years. And it was a very close kind of thing. I think I'm less inclined to get chummy with students than some faculty are. But somebody like Irv Alpish used to know mostly everybody. He was tremendous in terms of the knowing people on a personal basis. But people vary a little depending on their personality, I guess. But you really had to depend almost on the textbooks and so on. The students had nothing to read either unless they owned the books. So even though the library gradually expanded, it was still a very small institution for many, many years. What we did, we'd get textbooks, and then we'd get some discussion book or book of readings or something to go with it. That was a general practice. I remember the students being rather good, rather eager. I think considering the limited conditions, we did the best we could. it wasn't exactly a university yet, but people did graduate, they got degrees, they got their credentials, and we kept on growing.
Was there a change in the courses that you taught when you started letting in lower divisions?
What we did was convert the English history survey to a lower division course. And I think I began teaching occasional sections of Western civilization. So we put in courses that were parallel to the University of California system. There were courses of this sort in their curriculum, and they simply paralleled it. But at some point, we added upper division English history, of course, in Victorian England, British Empire, I think these came in a later time. But we kept the European upper division courses, as I recall, and the Far East remained an upper division course, as I recall. So there wasn't that much change in what I did. I think I just moved the English history survey into lower division. I forgot what year that occurred, too.
You weren't here too long before some people were let go, and there was some controversy about that.
Yeah. As I recall, there was a man in sociology by the name of Walker, Ed Walker. And he and Hugh Brown, I think, became good friends. And I think between the two of them, they felt the place was getting off to not a good start. And the reason it wasn't getting off to a good start is because they didn't think that Peterson had a conception of the university, which they wanted the place they wanted it to become. No, I think that at some point this basic determination on their part meant that they were going to challenge Peterson at some point for control of the university. My understanding is that they thought they had some external support for this as well. I don't know where. I was a young person, and I wasn't involved in all these deeper problems of California and all the rest. So I think the dismissal of faculty either was tied to this in some way, or became the focal point for criticism. This was the issue that we used to challenge, in a way, the leadership and where things were going. I don't know a great deal more of the background of that. And I told you, there may be people that know more about it than I do. But yes, there were a couple of people in English. One of them was Elizabeth Nielsen and Elizabeth something else.
Jacobs.
What?
Jacobs,
yeah, there's Jacobs. And there was a man in psychology, or in education, I think he was a psychologist. I've forgotten his name. I have a mental picture of him, but I can't remember the name. I don't know if he was one of those that was to be dismissed or not. Ross, I think his name was. I don't know his first name, but I think his last name was Ross.
Bob
Ross, it could be. But I was busy. I went out. I wasn't really that much inclined to get involved in these things. But Ed Walker managed to persuade an awful lot of people that there were great issues at stake in the context that was developing. Try to get as many of us as possible involved in it. I think very early, Dr. Kimball and I, at least, became drawn into whatever the revolutionary ferment was. I don't remember the details of this very much, except it led to an investigation by State Board of Education or somebody like that. And testimony was to be given to the board on whatever one knew or had experienced. A variety of issues arose. One of the most important was anti-Semitism, which was an accusation against the president. There were other issues. I've forgotten what all of them were, but that was one of them, and apparently it was alleged, at least, with respect to the dismissal of Liz Jacobs. I think I agreed to give testimony before this body that came, and essentially the administration had pretty well determined who their friends were and who they would send, and the opponents determined who their friends were and who they would send. And so you simply had to be a knowledgeable person on either side and watch the door of the hearing to know who was going and saying what about what. But basically, if you hadn't been invited by the president and his friends to appear and appeared, then you were an enemy. So it was a kind of a scary experience. You know, there wasn't any tenure. None of us had tenure and so on. But I'm not fully, my memory simply doesn't sufficiently latch on to what some of those early issues and things were and how I became involved. But I think it was partly this business of the notion of the discipline of being strong in their own right, and the trend of the college to really ignore those and become a kind of a training institution for occupations. This was sort of the clue that I think was presented. I think it was probably along those lines that my sympathies were enlisted, if I had to remember it correctly. Certainly in retrospect, it seemed to me that this was one of the big lines of cleavage that developed on campus as it went down into future years. I think probably Dr. Kimball and I were amenable to being enlisted too, partly because we felt so unhappy about what our particular division chairman was up to, Dr. Gregory. We were probably more at odds with him than with the president at this point. He really had no use for history, and he made that perfectly clear. He thought it was a kind of unhappy and unfortunate discipline, and it was really too bad to be hired for a historian and not more useful people. Which was threatening.
Did he see sociologists and political scientists as more useful?
Oh, yeah. Well, we would have been perfectly useful if we'd have been willing to fall in with a curriculum. I wish I had some of the curriculum design materials that were created at that time to give you some conception of what was going on. I don't know if they exist anywhere. You might, in the very early bulletins, be able to find some evidence. It's because some courses were actually instituted. And the next wave of hiring, people like Dr. Peters got drawn into teaching these social science things, and Kimball did some of them too. Well, there are things like one semester surveys of world history, which, you know, we thought was cute.
Yeah. Okay, that's clear to me, because I was thinking, in contrast to the, like, in the 1970s, the trend toward interdisciplinary study.
Yeah. Well, yeah, interdisciplinary studies are an integration at a higher level, and usually on a more limited way, and nobody talks a lot about throwing all the social sciences together and having social science 1 and social science 2.
Right.
Social science 3, and sort of developing concepts of the whole thing being very present-oriented and you know, problem-solving-oriented kind of thing. Which, you know, history doesn't fit in very well to a problem-solving-oriented kind of curriculum that's present-oriented. So as I said, there was really not much place for history people. And that's probably why we fell out at a fairly early point. But Dr. Kimball and I very quickly were at the bottom of the totem pole of favor, certainly by Mr. Gregory's book, and he didn't stand very well in our estimation. So this was really the point of conflict and confrontation. Certain people went along with him. The president also had a tendency to, on occasion, hire people without proper academic credentials, simply based on the fact that they had interesting life experiences which he thought they could somehow relate to students. And so he brought in people who were then translated into doing things which they were never really trained to do academically. That was shocking to those of us who felt that we were probably a lot stiffer. I mean, I ultimately came to believe in interdisciplinary programs, and when I was associate dean of letters and science, I invented all sorts of machinery to encourage them and foster them. And, most of the interdisciplinary programs that are flourishing on campus were born in that office. The faculty wanted to do it, and the administration that wanted to facilitate it. So I ultimately became a good deal more friendly towards those things. But I think it was at a different level, in a different way. It's one thing to talk about Far Eastern studies as an interdisciplinary program, and to talk about general social science 1 and 2.
Yeah, there's a difference between doing a survey of the whole Far East in one semester and having it over with.
Yeah. one really wouldn't talk much about ancient China or anything like that. You'd really be talking about, you know, the Far East, the present problems of the Far East, and maybe giving back, as books sometimes do, they give a little historical background, a paragraph or two. Well, we were to be the history faculty, we were to be the paragraphs that were somehow just sort of fitted in here and there to the picture. That really was not a very acceptable fate.
Yeah, that's right. Dr. Rockwell showed me a copy of the History of the Pacific textbook.
Oh, yes.
And I thought it must be an incredibly hard course to teach because you had to know the whole background of China and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But when I looked at the book, I found out that you didn't.
No, you didn't. No, no.
All you had to know was basically British and United States
mm-hmm.
diplomatic history.
Yeah, one of the authors of this was Dumke, who was the present chancellor, of course. Osgood. And, was it Osgood? That's why I brought in a kind of a standard Far Eastern course, which, by the way, took very well with students. It really responded very well. I enjoyed it. A lot of these were still one semester courses, but we focused almost entirely on China and Japan, and that was it for one semester. And so one, you could do a little bit more with that than you could with the other one.
So what was the outcome of the hearing of the by the State Board of Education. And
well, Peterson was confirmed, and Hugh Brown left, and Ed Walker left. Ed Walker went to Northern Arizona. Bill Strauss, who was another of the unhappy souls, he was a political scientist trained at Harvard. You can imagine how he fit into this. Also, incidentally, I'd written on Joseph Chamberlain, so we tend to duplicate very nicely around here. But Bill Strauss ultimately left and went to Northern Arizona. And then he and his wife got involved in the program in Korea and so on, and very interesting time of it. But some people left. Those who had testified on the wrong side were in a precarious state. And at some point after the testimony, when President Peterson was confirmed as president, I developed a very distinct impression in various conversations with Dr. Gregory that